Monday edition of the program, and we are very pleased to be joined by our next guest, who's the Deputy Director for Coalition Operations from Coalition Headquarters near Baghdad, Brigadier General Mark Kimmitt with us. General, how are you?
Great, and yourself?
Good. Appreciate your time today very much. A lot of things happening currently. I want to get to what's happening on the ground now as we speak in Fallujah and other places, but I want to first begin just kind of with the big picture. I don't know how aware you are of this, General, but the media performance, in my view, of covering this last year in Iraq has not been good. I think, there is such an intense focus on casualties or difficulties, something that have been anticipated all along, but very little focus on the fact that, hospitals have reopened, that oil is again flowing, that commerce is happening in Iraq. How frustrating is that for you and for coalition forces in the middle of it, General?
I think it's very frustrating. I think that all of us want to recognize the great work that's being done by our young soldiers and Marines, and it's more than just about what we call the bang bang. I mean, it's a lot about the fighting, but there's even more going on inside this country right now in terms of what the soldiers are doing and the Marines are doing in terms of rebuilding this country, whether it's the oil, the electricity, the infrastructure, the health services, the schools. They're making a significant contribution for which some of us are saddened that they don't get the credit that is due.
Give me your favorite example of something that is happening there that has just not been reported on or has not received the attention you believe it's due.
I think it's something as simple as 2,600 schools reopened. That didn't happen by magic. It didn't happen by contractors. It happened by a combination of American civilians, foreign civilians, and American soldiers. Kids are going back to school today, and there are more schools today than pre-war. And instead of learning the propaganda that they were taught during the days of Saddam, they're learning literature, they're learning mathematics, and they're learning their own grammar. So I think that's because, at the end of the day, it's really all about the future, and it's all about the children, what's going on here. We don't know what's going to happen in this particular generation, but we want this next generation to know what it's like to enjoy the same liberties that we take for granted every day.
And is there any logistic reason that the media on the ground there couldn't, in fact, show this? I mean, the picture sometimes we get of Iraq is the Fallujahs or the Najaf or where there might be a particular hotspot. What I think people lose is the context that the overwhelming majority of the country is moving towards democracy and moving towards a more sense of normal than they knew in the Saddam Hussein days. But is there any reason that the media couldn't go to these schools and tell that story?
Well, I'm not going to get into a discussion about the editorial policy. I know the media has a job to do. We just try to give them as many facts as we can, let them make their own mind up. But they're the ones that have the choice on which stories to tell. I just wish that it was more representative of what's happening across the board.
Well, we certainly share that view as well. And it isn't just the media, by the way. There's a lot of critics back here stateside as well. One of the favorites, and I want to just kind of go through a couple of these and then give you a chance to respond to them. One of the favorites is amongst some Republicans even, and probably more so Democrats, is that you and the other commanders on the ground there need more troops, that you don't have enough troops. Do you need more troops?
We get asked that question a lot. We do those reviews quite frequently. It's our assessment right now that for the near future, we're not going to need additional troops. There may be some time in the future when we take a look at the situation. The environment may change, but let's not speculate what the future is going to hold. We may need less troops in the future, but right now we're comfortable with the amount of soldiers that we have, Marines that we have, airmen and sailors that we have, and we feel that we're able to get the job done with what we have.
And have you ever been given a sense from anybody above you or any sort of sense that, boy, don't ask for more troops because we're not going to get them? I've always got the impression that where the president's saying, look, if General Abizay, General Sanchez, General Kimmitt, these people tell me they need more troops, they're going to get more troops. Have you ever seen or heard anything different?
No, really haven't.
All right. Another thing is the post-war planning. I think a lot of people have this vision that you should be able to just in a three-ring binder somewhere pull off the shelf something that says here is exactly how everything is going to go for the 365 days after the major combat operations end in Iraq. What about the assertion that the post-war planning has not been adequate?
Well, all I would say is that in any conflict, in any operation, the enemy has a vote. If the enemy didn't have a vote in this, everything would go according to plan. There's an old axiom that says the plan rarely survives the first contact. But I would tell you that even though the plans may not have predicted 100% of what we're going to see, and by and large, they provided a pretty good roadmap, a pretty good azimuth for where we need to take this country. Are we getting there as quickly as we would like? Absolutely not. Are we running into more enemy engagements than we had anticipated? Certainly so. But I think one of the great things about the American military and the civilian administrators over here is how quickly they've been able to react to the events on the ground and adjust the plans accordingly.
Who is the enemy?
I think you've really got two enemies here. I think you've got one enemy that is the remnants of Saddam's army. You're talking the Fedayeen Saddam. You're talking his intelligence service. You're talking the Mukhabarat. You're talking many of his former special security organization. We lump them together into an organization we typically call the former regime elements that are still trying desperately to return this country to the authoritarian regime where they were privileged players. There's another group, and that is the number of terrorist groups that we've seen in this region, and we all know who they are: Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Islam, the Zarqawi network. The first group wants to take this country back to the authoritarian regime of Saddam. I think the second group is even more problematic because they want to sort of Talibanize this country the way they did in Afghanistan and try to turn it into a chaotic terrorist enclave. Those two groups have certainly dissimilar intentions, very similar motivations. They hate all Westerners, and both will fail.
And by the way, you mentioned Zarqawi. You know, I think it's interesting. There is a fair amount of suspicion or disbelief that there is a connection between Saddam Hussein and terrorism that predates 9/11. But, you know, you have Zarqawi, who trained terrorists in Afghanistan, who is a card-carrying member of Al-Qaeda. After he was injured in the effort in Afghanistan, fled to receive medical care in Baghdad, and, you know, now is behind, as you mentioned, the violence that is part of one of the factions you're facing and coalition forces are facing there. It's important to remember this guy's history. Are we having any success in getting information about his whereabouts there, General?
I don't know if we're getting any closer specifically to him, but we certainly are rolling up a lot of his network throughout this country. And, you know, there's some sort of poetic justice. That hospital that treated Zarqawi is about 150 yards from my current location and now spends most of its time treating American wounded. That probably causes him no great fits at night.
How would you characterize the security situation there? I know we've heard a lot about the last number of weeks here being a difficult time as we get closer to that June 30th transfer of sovereignty and of power. How would you describe the security situation right now?
Well, frankly, the first couple of weeks in April was somewhat of a setback. There's no doubt that the amount of violence that we saw in those first 2 weeks from both the former regime elements and groups such as the Sadr militia sort of destabilized this country, took us back a couple of months. It almost was resembled the time around November when we were getting a spike in violence at that time. And frankly, in some days it was much worse than that. We're probably back to about the post-November time period. We certainly don't have the stability where it was January and February, you know, we still got some work to do. Where we typically get about 20 engagements a day, we're getting about 40 engagements a day. That's well down from the 100 engagements we were getting at the early part of April, but we still got some work to do. We measure stability not by any objective measure, but really the way we measure it is, are we able to continue the other lines of operation, restoration of the infrastructure, restoration of the economy, movement to governance? And even though it's pretty much at the high end of that, we still believe that the amount of instability in the country right now is not stopping us from carrying out those other three lines of operation.
And when you say, okay, even at the spike that you talked about of 100 of these instances per day, you're still talking about a relatively small part of the country where they're happening, correct?
Yeah, that's true, but we've also got, you know, objectively, the enemy took a new tactic where they started taking hostages and started interrupting the main supply routes. And that was a pretty interesting tactic because it intimidated the civilian workers and it also made it that much more difficult to us to get our supply lines in and out. And while that seems to be coming around now, there were a couple of days there when we were concerned that the lack of freedom of movement in the country and the fact that the civilian contractors were being intimidated, it was touch and go there for a while, but I think we're getting things back to a relatively normal pace.
Brigadier General Mark Kimmett is our guest. He's Deputy Director for Coalition Operations. We're speaking with him from Baghdad this morning. I want to ask you about Fallujah. First of all, you know, I'd like to hear in your own words an explanation of what has been happening in Fallujah. I think there's been sort of a separate opinions. One views it as U.S. bending over backwards, responding to members of the Iraqi Governing Council to say, let's give every last possibility a chance to resolve this peacefully. Others say, gosh, by a ceasefire, we're sending the wrong message. What is, up until today, and the resumption of the hostile activities, been our position with Fallujah?
Well, I think you characterized it well in the first case. The fact is, we were approached by some of the members of the Interim Governing Council saying, let's give peace a chance. We certainly understand that you've got more than enough military power to march into Fallujah and finish this fight quickly. We are concerned about the long-term blowback from that operation, so let's give peace a chance. And we would say that over the past 10, 15 days, we have attempted to use that political track. We have bent over backwards in terms of timelines, in terms of expectations, in terms of weapons turn-ins. If you score our efforts against that of the insurgents, it is clear that you can't take away any other conclusion from that discussion other than the insurgents are looking for a fight. We're going to try to make it peaceful, but if they want to fight, they're going to get a fight. And if they don't want to give up control of the city of Fallujah, then the Marines will take it back from them.
And one of the things you asked is for them, for instance, to turn over their weapons, and they gave you a bunch of stuff out of a junkyard, right?
I think most junkyards would have been insulted by saying that stuff came from their place.
So these guys, obviously, despite your best efforts, were not operating in good faith, and so fighting has resumed there, correct?
Well, first of all, they are not acting in good faith. There's no doubt about that. Fighting has resumed in one small part of the northwest portion of Fallujah. It was a pretty intense firefight, and it involved probably one or two platoons. But I would not say that the whole ring around Fallujah is now embroiled in fighting. It was just one small portion today.
All right. We should also point out that the fighting actually started when troops came under fire with RPG, rocket-propelled grenades fired from a mosque, correct?